Okay, back to chapter 11. Okay, we're dealing with the Antichrist, and we're down to chapter 11, verses 40 through 45, describing his conquests. That'll be five under point five, small b. What these verses describe is the war that will break out in the middle of the tribulation, which we already were told back in chapter 7, where he will begin his war against the 10 kings. So it begins with a statement, at the time of the end, the same phrase which was used in verse 35. So it first of all introduced in verse 35 the general policy and practices of the Antichrist in verses 36 to 39, and now it introduces the specific activities in verses 40 to 45. It points to the very beginning of the second half of the tribulation, when he will attain full political and religious authority. And the ones he wars against is, first of all, the king of the south. And the king of the south throughout Daniel 11 has been the king of Egypt. And that's the first king that he will kill. The king of the north throughout this chapter has been Syria. As the second king he will kill will be the king of Syria. The king of the south, the king of the will contend with him. The king of the north shall come up against him like a whirlwind, meaning suddenly, and will come with armor, both army and navy. He mentions chariots and horsemen as army, ships of war as the navy. And he will defeat the opposition. He shall enter into the countries. He shall overthrow and pass through. And again, notice the use of the figure of a flood, which always symbolizes, when used symbolically, of a military invasion. And furthermore, in verse 41, he shall also enter into the glorious land. In mid-tribulation, he will enter Israel. It's the same Gentile takeover of Israel and the temple compound described in Revelation 11, verse 1 and 2. Revelation 11, verse 1 and 2, which sets the stage for the abomination of desolation that Daniel mentioned in Daniel 9, verse 27. Daniel 9, 27, also mentioned in Matthew 24, verse 15. Matthew 24, 15. Paul also mentioned it in 2 Thess, chapter 2, verse 3 and 4. 2 Thess 2, 3 and 4. He will sit in a temple of God, setting himself forth as God. It goes on to say, many countries shall be overthrown. Antichrist will succeed bit by bit in the political takeover of the entire world. However, notice the phrase, but these shall be delivered out of his hands. There's going to be three nations that will escape his domination, and they're named as Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Now, all three of these ancient countries form only one country today in the modern-day kingdom of the Jordan. So modern-day Jordan includes Edom, Moab, and Ammon, and also includes Gilead, the today's borders. There's a principle in Jewish history that when one part of the world turns against the Jews, God always makes sure there's another part of the world for the Jews to escape to. For example, among the more important years in Jewish history is the year 1492. That was the year at the beginning with Spain, followed by Portugal, and then followed by other countries, began to expel the Jews from their territories. So it is no accident that was also the same year Columbus discovered the New World that very quickly became a refuge for Jewish persecution, for Jewish people to flee to. Now, in the tribulation, the whole world on the Antichrist will turn against the Jews, so God still makes sure there is this one part of the world where the Jews can flee to. The exact place where they flee to is given several clues. First of all, in Matthew chapter 24, verses 15 to 22, Matthew 24, 15 to 22, he points out that the abomination of desolation will be assigned to the Jews to flee the land. And where they will flee to will be to flee to the mountains. And so the freedom of the Transjordanian territory will give the Jews a way to escape to. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 6, Revelation 12, verse 6, and also verses 13 and 14, gives two more clues. Matthew, the mountains, and now it'll also be desert territory. And thirdly, it'll be to a pre-existing place. A pre-existing place. An exact place is finally named in Micah chapter 2, verse 12. Micah 2, verse 12. The Hebrew name which he gives is the city of Bozrah, spelled in English B-O-Z-R-A-H, B-O-Z-R-A-H, but today it's known by its Greek name as Petra. And Petra, Bozrah, is in the territory of ancient Edom, which is now southern Jordan. And so what the Jews will be fleeing to is into southern Jordan, ancient Edom, and more specifically, the city of Bozrah or Petra. And that will serve as the city of refuge for the Jews in the second half of the tribulation. Then verses 42 and 43 goes on to describe the fall of Egypt. He shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries. All other nations do not escape. The land of Egypt shall not escape. And again, that's the first of the three kings he will kill. And then comes the spoiling of Egypt. He shall have power over all the treasures of gold and silver, the precious things of Egypt. He mentions the fall of African areas, Libya and Ethiopia. And then in verse 44, the fall of Syria and Mesopotamia. Tidings out of the east trouble him. The east is Mesopotamia. Today that is Iraq. And this is the third of the three kings he will kill. The three kings he kills is the king of the south, Egypt, the king of the north, Syria, the king of the east, Mesopotamia. Tidings of the north will trouble him, and that's why he moves against the king of the north. He shall go forth with great fury, because of the tidings that come to him from the north and south, or north and east, to destroy and to sweep away. And so all three kings eventually annihilated, which then leads to the other seven kings simply submitting to his authority. And he sets up his temporary headquarters in the captured city of Jerusalem in verse 45. He shall plant the tents of his palace. The tent here is a word meaning a tent of a military commander or the tent of a general. And the calling of palace means this is a royal tent that will be erected. Between the seas, between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, at the glorious holy mountain, at the Temple Mount. So that's where he will erect his palace tent, on the Temple Mount. This point is also made in Revelation 11, verse 1 and 2. Revelation 11, verse 1 and 2. And that's when he sets up the abomination of desolation, where an image made of him by the false prophet, and with supernatural power, the image becomes the living image, able to speak and to kill. And now, because he will now stay in Jerusalem at this stage, what he does is have the image set up in the Holy of Holies of the Jewish temple, so that becomes his religious headquarters. Ultimately, he'll go to Babylon, and Babylon, the rebuilt city of Babylon, will be the city that will serve as his political and economic world headquarters. And these are the events that will trigger the Jews to flee Jerusalem, to flee the land. And the majority of the Jews who survive the tribulation will find themselves hiding in Bozrah or Petra. Now verse 45 points out the end, he shall come to his end and none shall help him. And we know from chapter 13 of Revelation, chapter 13 verses 1 through 10, in that war against the 10 kings, he will be killed. But then he's resurrected back to life by Satan. In Revelation chapter 13, verse 3, verse 12, and verse 14, Revelation 13, verses 3, 12, and 13. And then the war will continue when he finally takes full control of the world politically as well as religiously. Now, verse 1 of chapter 12, Michael and Israel. And at that time, the time of the end of chapter 11, verse 40, Michael shall stand up. This is Michael, the archangel, shall stand up, again, a military term. He will war against Satan and the fallen angels. So we know from Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 9, Revelation 12, 7 through 9, in the midpoint of tribulation, an angelic war break out where Satan now dwells in the atmospheric heavens. He'll be cast down to the earth and confined to the earth for the second half of his trip of the tribulation. And because of his confinement, he will now organize a Nazi-like program for the total annihilation of the Jewish people to avoid the second coming. As the archangel, he's in authority over all the angels, but he's also the great prince, because he's also the guardian angel over Israel. And the reason Israel survived the tribulation is because of Michael's work. So Michael, who stands for the children of your people, stands for means fight for the children of your people, Daniel's people, the Jewish people. And one example of this is Revelation chapter 12, verses 15 and 16. Revelation 12, verses 15 and 16. So again, Israel will survive the tribulation as an identifiable people because of Michael, the chief prince of Israel. It says there shall be a time of trouble, the great tribulation. And in Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7, Jeremiah 30, verse 7, Daniel's contemporary. Jeremiah referred to that time as the time of Jacob's trouble. The time of Jacob's trouble. But he then adds, but he shall be saved out of it. And he says, such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And the persecution of Jews will suffer in the tribulation will supersede all previous persecutions of the Jews. It'll supersede what happened at the Nazi Holocaust. The same point Jesus makes in Matthew 24 and verse 21. 24, 21. So Daniel adds, at that time your people shall be delivered. Again, Israel as a nation will survive. Everyone that shall be found written in the book. This may refer to the book of life, or it may refer to the book, to the Lamb's book of life. But the elect of Israel will escape and survive. But according to Zechariah chapter 13, verse 8 and 9, Zechariah 13, 8 and 9, only one-third of the Jewish population living when the tribulation begins will survive it. Two-thirds will not survive it. Then in verses 2 and 3, you have the account of a resurrection that will occur following the events of the second coming. And this resurrection of verses 2 and 3 will involve the Old Testament saints, a promise made back in Isaiah chapter 26, verse 19. Isaiah 26, verse 19. Also the tribulation saints in Revelation 20, verses 4 through 6. Revelation 20, verses 4 through 6. And so living Israel, the Jews who survive as believers, will enter in their natural state into the Messianic kingdom. They'll be joined by the Old Testament saints. So both living Israel and resurrected Israel will live together in the promised land, which they'll have for the first time, all of the promised land. So many from among the sleepers, this would be the righteous, will be resurrected at this point of time. But others, the meaning the unbelieving element, won't be resurrected until after the kingdom. That's in Isaiah chapter 21, verses 21 and 22, Isaiah 24, 21, 22, and Revelation 20, verse 5, and verses 12 through 14. Revelation 20, verse 5, and 12 through 14. And he points out some to everlasting life. This is the first mention in the Old Testament about the separation of resurrections. And so the first resurrection is a term, the resurrection of believers. And the first resurrection comes in five different stages. The first stage has already been fulfilled, the resurrection of the Messiah, and therefore is called the first fruits of the first resurrection. The second stage will be the rapture of the church, which will happen before the tribulation. The third stage will be the resurrection of the two witnesses in the middle of the tribulation. The fourth stage will be the resurrection of the Old Testament saints. And the final stage will be the resurrection of the tribulation saints in Revelation 20, verse 4, which is why it says that with the resurrection of the tribulation saints, that will complete the first resurrection, and no one else will live again until 1,000 years pass, and those resurrected after 1,000 years are those who are going to be unbelievers. So Daniel, those resurrected at that point of time will be to shame and everlasting contempt. And verse 3 then describes the state of the resurrected saints after the resurrection. They that are wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. The firmament is the sheen of the sky, or the shining vault, where all of its stars are shining. And emphasizing the brightness of the firmament, it's often a symbol of the Shekinah glory, and so the resurrected saints will reflect the Shekinah glory in the same way that the face of Moses reflected his encounter with the Shekinah on Mount Sinai, and his face began to shine. And they that turn many to righteousness during the tribulation, like the 144,000 Jews, for example, will be as the stars, emphasis on the shining of the stars. Now, as you look at the sky at nighttime, you see myriads of stars, but not every star is as bright as other stars. And the point he's making is that not every saint will be able to equally shine, because how we shine will depend upon how we serve the Lord at our time at the present life. So some saints will shine brighter than other saints. But all saints will be shining some measure of the Shekinah glory. It'll be easily to tell visibly which are resurrected individuals and which are still in the natural state. And then in verse 4, you have the sealing of the book, more correct, the scroll. But you, Daniel, shut up the words. Shut up, close it off. The words that began with chapter 10 through chapter 12. Chapters 1 through 9 were already written. And now what he's going to write in chapters 10 to 12 is the final revelation he will receive. So shut up, close the work, seal it. So shut up the words of chapters 10 to 12, seal the book to keep it safe, also to keep it closed. It needs to keep it close because for a period of time it will not be understood. There are too many gaps in the information. And so when John writes the book of Revelation, he's told the opposite. Do not seal your book. Do not seal your scroll. Because the gaps in Daniel are now filled in by the book of Revelation. So this book needs to be sealed only until the book of Revelation is written, and then prophecy can be further understood. So the book he mentions, the book of Daniel, the book is now complete with these last chapters. It also implies to Daniel, this is the last vision, the last information he will be given. He says, even to the time of the end. The time of the end is the great tribulation, sealed to be preserved for tribulation times. Much of the context concerns those that will have to live through the tribulation. Then he says, many shall run to and fro, which has often been pulled out of context and refers to modern day travel. But actually, this is not the emphasis of the phrase. Many shall run to and fro. And running to and fro refers to not for travel, but for a quest of knowledge. Not for travel, but a quest for knowledge. You see examples of this in 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9, 2 Chronicles 16, 9, Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 1, Jeremiah 5, verse 1, Amos 8, verse 12, Amos 8, 12, Zechariah chapter 4, verse 10, Zechariah 4, 10. So people be running to and fro, seeking knowledge. Knowledge about the end days in general, but about the knowledge of the prophecies of the book of Daniel in particular. As a result, knowledge shall be increased. In the Hebrew, it is specific. It is the knowledge. The knowledge of the book of Daniel shall be increased. So the paraphrase was really teaching, many shall run to and fro in their desire for knowledge of last things. And finally get in the book of Daniel, because it would have been preserved to the end, their knowledge shall be increased. That's the focus of the verse. And now we come to capital C, the conclusion, in verses 5 through 13. And under point 1, the extent and purpose of the period in verses 5 through 7. In verse 5, there's the appearance of two other angelic beings. I, Daniel, looked, and there were other two. In addition to the angel that has been talking to Daniel, now there are two other angels, altogether three. And the two new angels that now appear, each one stands at one side of the river, on the other side of the river, which is the Tigris in this context. And these two angels will serve as witnesses. In verse 6, the question is raised to the man that was clothed in linen, the one that's been talking to Daniel. Now he's standing above the waters, which are put in between the two other angelic beings. And he's standing above the river, and the other two are by the shoreline, one side and the other side. And the question is, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? How long? What will be the length of time? These wonders, the vision he saw from chapter 11, verse 36 to chapter 12, verse 4, what will be the duration of the persecution? Answer comes in verse 7. By the man clothed in linen, he held up his right hand and left hand unto heaven. Normally in biblical history, what you find is only one hand being raised, as in Genesis chapter 14, verse 22, Genesis 14, 22. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 40, Deuteronomy 32, verse 40. By raising both hands, this shows the solemnity of the oath. And he swears by him that is forever, forever, meaning he swears by God. It shall be for a time, times and a half a time. Same phrase that was used back in chapter 7, verse 25. It refers to the second half of the tribulation. But then he also spells out one of the purposes of this period of time. And when they have made an end of breaking in pieces the power or the will of the holy people all these things shall be finished. The tribulation must continue until the power, or better, the will of the holy people is finally broken, until they finally stop trying to establish their own righteousness and seek the righteousness of God through the Messiah Jesus. And some major purpose of tribulation is to bring about Israel's national salvation, Israel's national repentance. And in verse 8, Daniel makes another request. I heard, but understood not, as already happened more than once. Request, O Lord, what shall be the issue of these things? As in the past, Daniel is asking for further clarification. He says, the issue, what will be the final outcome? What will be the latter end? He's not asking now how long, that much he has been told, but what? What is the event that will bring all this to an end? And the answer is given elsewhere, the second coming of the Messiah. The response of the angels in verses 9 through 13, turn to your next page. And in verse 9, again the sealing, go your way, Daniel, meaning ask me no more questions, no more answers will be given. Stop asking these questions and do not be concerned. But for the words are shut up and sealed. Same word that was used in verse 4. And the point is the answer to Daniel's question is already contained in the book of Daniel. He doesn't quite understand what he's told, what has been told previously. But in accordance with chapter 12, verse 4, more will be known later. Because ultimately, this is not meant for Daniel individually, but for his own people in the tribulation. And in verse 10, there's a contrast between the wise and the wicked. The wise are the tribulation saints. They shall purify themselves, make themselves white, and be refined. The wise shall understand. And while Daniel will not yet understand the meanings of some of his prophecies, others will later, those in the great tribulation. As for the wicked, they shall do wickedly still. They will not understand even now or later. Now he gives a couple of other figures. Let's see, I know I did it somewhere here. Is. Spot here. No.
Oh, that's it. That's the bit.
You want. Now you got it. See.
That's the bit you want.
Yeah. Okay, several times now we've seen within the book of Daniel, also verified later in the book of Revelation, the second half of the tribulation will be 1,260 days. That's one figure. Now, verse 11, we're given yet another figure. It says, from the time that the continual burnt offering shall be taken away, from the time the abomination of desolation is set up, and that refers to an image, and that would be the image of the Antichrist detailed in Revelation 13, verses 14 and 15. Revelation 13, 14 and 15 was mentioned a bit earlier in chapter 9, verse 27 of Daniel 9:27. And the end of it is 1,290 days. Now again, the second half of tribulation is exactly 1,260 days, not an additional 30 days for 1,290 days. And so the abomination of desolation, which begins in the midpoint of tribulation, will have to continue in the Jewish temple for additional 30 days beyond the end of tribulation, for 30 days beyond the time of the second coming. In verse 12, we're then given a third number, 1,335 days, which additional period of 45 days, but total of 75 days. And what he's referring to, that between the end of tribulation and the start of the Messianic kingdom will be a 75-day interval. A 75-day interval. It also says in verse 12, the one who attains the 1,335th day is the one that will be blessed. He will receive the blessings of the Messianic kingdom. But many who survived the tribulation will not survive the 75-day period. For example, there's the judgment of the Gentiles described in Joel 3, verses 1 through 3. Joel 3, verses 1 through 3. Also, Matthew 25, verses 31 through 46. Matthew 25, verses 31 through 46. And the goat Gentiles will not survive the 75-day period, while the sheep Gentiles will survive it. And there's many other reasons for the 75-day period that's not listed here, but then the whole world will be, have to be miraculously renovated in preparation for the kingdom. There must be the final regathering of all the Jews into the land. There must be the rebuilding of Jerusalem, the erection of the millennial temple. All that will occur in just 75 days between the close of the tribulation and the start of the kingdom. But in verse 13, he ends with Daniel's future. Go your way. A reaffirmation of chapter 12, verse 9. No more information will be given until the end be, until the end of times of Gentiles, until the end of tribulation times. For you shall rest. Daniel will die. He's already over 80 years old. And shall stand in your lot. The word lot means inheritance. Daniel will be resurrected with others as prophesied in chapter 12, verse 2. At the end of days, he'll be resurrected in that same 75-day period as all the other Old Testament saints will be resurrected. And so for those of you that were skeptical, we did finish the whole book. Okay, now we'll deal with the questions I got. I can turn this noisy machine off. Okay. Will the temple be rebuilt on the Temple Mount? If the Jews could build a temple anywhere outside the Temple Mount, they would have already done it by now. But the only place that the temple could be rebuilt is on the Temple Mount where the first and second temple stood. That's where the third temple will stand. But the third temple, remember, God does not sanction Isaiah 66 verses 1 through 6. Isaiah 66 verses 1 through 6 will not be sanctioned by God. It'll be the tribulation temple, but the millennial temple will not stand on the same mount. In fact, the geography will change somewhat radically. And the temple building itself is huge. It's a 1 mile square. And the temple compound is a quarter mile square. It wouldn't fit on the modern-day Temple Mount. And so the third temple will be on Temple Mount, but the middle temple will be built somewhere on a brand new mountain that does not yet exist. When does the time of the Gentiles begin? It began with the destruction of the city and the temple in 586 BC. In 586 BC is when the last Davidic king was removed from the Davidic throne. And since that time, no one has sat upon the Davidic throne. At the time the Gentiles began, when the last Davidic king was removed, and the time the Gentiles began at that point with Babylon, it will continue until once again, you have a Davidic king upon the Davidic throne, which will be the Messiah at the second coming. And then again, the Antichrist, as we saw in this book, is the last Gentile ruler of the four Gentile empire. Until he has ruled, the time of the Gentiles have not yet ended. What is the timeline? Chapter 8:23 refers to their reign, singular, so that does mean Antichrist comes during the one world government. Well, the pronoun they does not refer to the 10 kingdoms, which was already mentioned in chapter 7 and chapter 8. What's referring is that in the latter days of the times of the Gentile kings, of the Gentile empires, latter days of that kingdom, that the Antichrist will finally rise to power. So rise to power in the 10 division stage, because they have to be contemporary to some degree, because he kills three and other seven submit to him. So he will rise to power not during the one world government stage, but during the 10 division stage. And then the war will begin. Well, this will be divided before the tribulation. Will it be a left-wing government in Israel who will sign the covenant of the Antichrist? I don't know if it will be left-wing or right-wing or centrist government. It will be the government of Israel. As to where they are spiritually and politically, the Bible does not reveal. But will there be a division of the land? The final is how much land the Jews control will be determined not by the UN, not by any combination of governments, not by President Trump. God determines how much land the Jews enjoy any point of time. And because this was never an obedient nation, throughout the whole history of the Hebrew Bible, what do you see? More or less. For example, under Joshua, more. Judges, less. David and Solomon, more. When the kingdom divided, less again. And the principle of more or less continued until Israel went to Assyrian captivity, Judah to Babylonian captivity. In the last 70 years of Israel's modern history, the same principle, 1948, less. 1967, more. Recent negotiations, less again. And the principle of more or less will continue until they become a believing people. Only then will they get all of the land, settle all the land, and live in peace in the land. So whether they've already given up territory, like the Gaza Strip and so on, will they give up more territory? I'm not a prophet or son of a prophet. I don't know if that will do. I'm never in favor of it. But will they do it? I don't know. But I do know God controls how much land the Jewish people have. And the present state will continue until the middle of tribulation. Then there'll be a collapse of the government. There'll be one more exile from the land, mostly in the Middle East area. After 3.5 years of that exile, they'll finally come to faith. Only then will they all go back. Only then will they sell all the promised land and live in peace, but not before they become believing people. So God will determine whether there'll be further withdrawals or not. Well, only time will tell. What form will the mark of the beast take? It'll take the form of three sixes, just like it reads. Three sixes. And it'll be the numerical value of Antichrist's name, whatever that may be, but the form will be three sixes. A chip?
A chip. That's what I was meaning.
Well, okay. No problem. It won't be a chip below the skin because the Greek word used the word epi, which means a palm. Be more like a tattoo or something similar, but be visible on the skin, not invisible. Because what the Antichrist wants is there's immediate recognition who's worshiping him, who's not worshiping him. And therefore, it'll have to be on top of the skin, and the Greek emphasis is that it has to be on top of the skin. Yeah, can the right hand on the forehead. Those who are more zealous will put on their forehead. And those people today who are so enamored with tattoos will probably put on their forehead. Psalm 83 prophecy. How this happens, or is it still future? Psalm 83 in the first 8 verses of Psalm 83 has been fulfilled in Israel's present history with the War of Independence in 1948 and the 60 War in 1967. That's when all of the specific territories he mentions came against Israel. But verses 9 through the rest of the chapter won't be fulfilled until the tribulation. So it follows the double reference, but verses 1 through 8 have been fulfilled already. There was a question about the Ancient of Days mentioned in Daniel 7, verses 9 through 10, verses 13 through 14, and verse 22. The Ancient of Days is described similarly to the Lord Jesus in Revelation 1. In Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, the Son of Man is mentioned alongside him. The Ancient of Days is the Ancient of Days, God the Father, who is invisible. In the context of Daniel 7, because the Son of Man is the Messiah, therefore the Ancient of Days has to be something other. It now would be God the Father. Now, generally speaking, by the way, God the Father is invisible, so is the Spirit invisible, so was God the Son before he became incarnate. Because God is a Spirit, and they who worship us, and that's true for all three members of the Trinity. The difference with the second person is that at the incarnation, he added to his deity, humanity. So what we see, we won't see his deity, that's invisible. We'll see his humanity. But the God can take on certain forms, like he often took the form of the Shekinah glory and came either as a light, fire, or cloud, or a combination of those three things. He also appears, and the Son appears as the angel of Jehovah. So there are visible appearances of God, but this is not seeing God as he really is. As the Bible says, no one can see him and survive. So nobody will see God as he really is, at least not in this age. But God, all three members of the triune God can take on the visible form of some kind. But still, it hides the fact of his deity because of those reasons. Can you please expand on what you said? Antichrist is one of the Nephilim, and that they have no desire for men. Where do you find this information? Why don't you turn to Genesis chapter 3. In chapter 3, you have the first prophecy about the coming of the Messiah. In verse 16, verse 15, it was the first prophecy about the Messiah is not given to Adam, not given to Eve, but specifically to Satan. I will put enmity between you, that's Satan, and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, he shall bruise your head, you shall bruise his heel. And notice the two different seeds which are mentioned here. The seed of the woman, in the seed of Satan. We have the same word used twice in the same verse. It must be understood in the same way as the text tells you otherwise, and there's nothing here to indicate it must be taken otherwise. So let's begin with the seed of the woman. Now, by calling the Messiah the seed of the woman, that breaks the biblical norm. Because you read that of all the genealogies in the Hebrew Bible, well, there are many, and the two genealogies in the New Testament, they trace the male line. Women are either not mentioned at all. If they are mentioned, they're mentioned in passing, not directly relevant to the genealogy. So now Moses points out, for some reason, which he does not explain, the woman, the Messiah be reckoned not after the seed of the man, but the seed of the woman. And that's not explained until Isaiah comes along. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, Isaiah 7, 14, the Messiah will be conceived and born of a virgin. All of us here have our humanity from two biological people, our father and our mother. But the Messiah, his whole humanity comes from only one biological source. He's no biological father, only a biological mother. And therefore with him you have no choice. You have to trace his seed, the seed of the woman. So putting Isaiah and Genesis together, the seed of the woman emphasizes there'll be a supernatural conception producing the messianic person, a supernatural conception. Now that background should help us understand the seed of Satan. The seed of Satan is that he'll be a direct descendant of Satan himself. Now Satan now knows that the that the descendant of the woman he tempted will come and defeat him. So what he tries to do in Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4, Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4, he tries to corrupt the seed of the woman so Messiah could not come. So he has many of his fallen angels take on human form. And again, when angels appear visibly, they always appear as young men. And the term sons of God, when used in the Hebrew Bible, everywhere else always refers to angels. And nobody debates that point, because everywhere else the term B'nai Elohim, sons of God, is used, it's always angelic. Now, some want to make chapter 6 the one exception, but there's no good reason to make it the exception. So these are fallen angels who take on human form, and Satan has them intermarrying with human women. And what they produce is not like King James, they produce giants. That's not the meaning of the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word for giants is the word anakim, but this is Nephilim. And Nephilim were a race of fallen ones who were not purely angel, natural human. They could not reproduce themselves. Let me give an example in the animal kingdom. If you want to have a mule, how do you get a mule? You cross a horse and a donkey. But mules don't reproduce themselves, so the more mules you want, the more crossing you have to do with donkeys and horses. Now suppose you separate horses and separate donkeys, and so you only have them mate, you only don't have horses mating with horses, you don't have donkeys mating with donkeys, you only have horses and donkeys coming together. You'll get a lot of mules. Eventually, the horses disappear, the donkeys disappear, all you have is all these mules, and when they die, that's it. They don't reproduce themselves. That's the basic tactic that you find him doing. He's trying to corrupt the seed of women so the Messiah cannot appear. And he used his own fallen angels to do this. But there was one line that remained untouched by this conspiracy. And this led to the family of Noah, and the family of Noah was spared, and the Nephilim all died out in the flood. And the angels that participated in that action are now confined in a special place the Bible calls Tartarus, T-A-R-T-R-U-S, in 2 Peter chapter 2. But not getting back, what happened in Genesis, in the prophecy of Genesis 3:15, is that someday Satan is going to impregnate a Gentile woman of Roman origin to produce his seed. So he's like the Nephilim. He cannot reproduce himself. And that will be the Antichrist. And that's why he has no desire for women. In modern interpretation, a lot of people say, well, that shows he'll be homosexual. It doesn't really prove he's homosexual. It's more likely he's among the Nephilim, which is why he has no desire for women or respect for women. But the Antichrist will be of the seed of Satan. And in 2 Thess chapter 2, verse 8, Paul writes, whose coming is by the power or the energizing of Satan. And so that's why he's in that special category. Okay, we'll bring about 4 minutes over time, but hopefully you'll be forgiving.